So if a person wants to walk, it doesn't work very well to only put one's attention on the right leg and have no attention at all on the left leg. In order to walk, you have to have kind of somehow equal attention on both legs. Imagine someone, all the attention on one leg, maybe they'd be hopping around, or the left leg would just be dragging along. It doesn't work. You have to have somehow, the attention has to be kind of even, both legs. So in the same sense, we could say there are two legs to mindfulness practice, and it's really necessary to have, really helpful to have attention kind of equally on both legs. However, many people focus mostly on one at the exclusion of the other. And the two legs that I'd like to posit tonight is, the first one is paying attention to what's happening, which is kind of generic for what we're talking about in Vipassana and mindfulness meditation. So just noticing what's happening. And that could be noticing what's happening externally. And so being present for what's happening, certain presence of mind. So you're really here, inhabiting and living, aware of what's happening in this world that you're living in. Not spaced out, not lost in future thinking or past thinking or fantasy. It could also mean paying attention to what's going on inside of here, inside of oneself. One's feelings, one's thoughts, one's beliefs, one's reactions, what's going on in the body. So just kind of, so the whole show, inner and outer show, just paying attention to what's happening. So we call that paying attention to what's happening. The other leg is paying attention to what your relationship is to what's happening. So there's what's happening and then how you relate to it. And there are some people who only pay attention to what is happening and without really noticing that there's a big, big thing going on, big elephant in the room, which is your relationship, your attitude, your reaction to what is happening. Now, relationships, this way is very important. I read recently someone who defined religion as being a set of beliefs and values and practices that have some kind of ultimate meaning. But spirituality has to do about our relationship to those beliefs and practices and values. So in Buddhism, there's the teachings of the Buddha, and then there's what is our relationship to those teachings. There's the Buddha, for example, and what's our relationship to the Buddha? There's a set of practices that we teach, and what's your relationship to those practices? So spirituality in this definition had to do with that relationship. And so taking some care and some attention to your relationship, to you, what you bring to the table, what you bring to the equation is very important. And it isn't that you're unimportant actually here, you're very important. And your relationship, well, what you do, what you contribute, is a key part of what we investigate. If you only focus on what you contribute, your relationship, which some people sometimes do, then it's pretty lopsided as well. Then it's kind of a dead end. You're kind of spinning around in your own, I don't know what the right word is, your own, depend. I don't know what you spin around in. So there's an art to going back and forth and noticing what's happening and your relationship to it. So for example, we do breath meditation, focusing the attention on the breath. And so the breath can be a certain way. It could be, for example, it can be hard to be present for the breath. The mind is so easily distracted. The mind keeps spinning off. And that's kind of the basic what's happening. You're trying to be with the breath, the mind is spinning off. But we usually don't leave it that simple. We enter into a relationship with that phenomena. Meditators can commonly get angry, get discouraged. They can have a judgment what that means. So the part of the relationship is judging. This means that my meditation is going poorly. This means I'm a bad meditator. This means that I should be doing knitting. So we enter in a relationship where we're judging the situation. So we add meaning to it or judgment. We also then sometimes based on that, our relationship is emotional. We can get discouraged, we can get angry, We can get afraid. We can get anxious. We can get embarrassed. So all those things that happen in relationship to this basic thing that's going on. Or we could have some kind of strong volitional activity that arises in relationship to this. We see this is what's going on, and because of that, I'm not going to try harder. I'm going to bear down the breath. Or I'm going to try something else. There's all kinds of things, decisions that are made that come out of that relationship to what's going on. So, for example, with my wandering mind on retreat, I notice that if I'm relaxed about the wandering mind, that I actually get more settled more quickly than if I get anxious about the wandering mind. If I get caught up in relating to it anxiously, oh, this is bad, I must do something, and kind of making all this meaning and stuff, I kind of spin myself out even more. But if I'm very relaxed about it, I'm kind of, basically it's okay, I'm not bothered by it, then it's a lot easier to kind of all that phenomena of thinking kind of settle away and come back. So, that's in relationship to, breathing. But it could be towards anything. In Buddhism, there are kind of there's kind of a divide in Buddhism between those relationships we can form with our experience, which are healthy or health-producing, and those which are unhealthy or unhealth-producing. And the ones, not healthy in some kind of medical way, but maybe in a kind of spiritual way. So the unhealthy ones are things that are, this is kind of the summary in three kind of broad categories, is relationships that somehow entail greed or ill will or delusion, confusion. And so when we relate to what's happening out of greed, I want that, I want, if that's strong enough, that momentum of desire, greed, of lust, of craving, called in Buddhism a kind of a poison, because it can have such a big impact on our body, our heart, our mind, our emotions and everything. And I certainly see it in my own body. And that's one of the things I think is really wonderful meditation for me, is that I can pick up in the course of the day certain kind of momentum in my relationship to the world, relationship to myself, my reactions and my desires, kind of getting things done or whatever. And I think everything's fine until I sit down to meditate, and then I feel, wow, all that momentum I was doing that I was doing in my daily life is held in my shoulders and my arms and my chest and my cheeks and my nose, and all kinds of places the muscles kind of are revved up a little bit or tight. And meditation gives me a chance to settle that down. And it can be innocent enough, that momentum, but also you can kind of feel the way it kind of creates a kind of unhealthy situation in our body when we're kind of stressed out a lot around greed, or same thing around ill will or hate. So if we really have strong ill will to what's happening, we're in a relationship to it. So we can have strong desire for spiritual life, and it can be a little bit unhealthy to do that because it's greedy for it. And I've known people involved in Buddhism for whom their relationship to Buddhism, to Buddhist practice and Buddhist ideas and values, their relationship is a really big problem. But because they're relating to this great world religion that's ultimately perfect and right and great, and who are they to argue against it? They're so inspired. They don't look at themselves in relationship to it. They're kind of blinded by this greatness of Buddhism, so-called greatness, so-called Buddhism. And but we kind of train ourselves to look back, turn the mirror of attention back to ourselves. How am I relating to this? Even if something is really wonderful, am I relating to it in a way that is healthy or unhealthy? Is it greedy? Is it, that's a very broad range of relationships. Or is it ill will or hate? Or is it confused? The opposite of those, which are considered the more three broad healthy, non-poisonous or health-producing attitudes or relationships, are the opposite of these in a sense: generosity, love, and wisdom. So is there a sense of generosity to what's going on? So when I described to you my experience in meditation, that I found that being relaxed about my wandering mind was helpful for me, it was in a sense kind of a generous, more generous. Oh, look at that. Gil's mind is wandering off again. And I was generous to it. In fact, what I learned to do sometimes was I don't know if this is, you know, if you start slipping on the sidewalk, the wet sidewalk or something, if you go with a fall briefly, just very briefly, you're more likely to catch yourself than if you try immediately to catch yourself. Hopefully you had that experience. And so the same thing with a wandering mind. I kind of go with it a little bit. And kind of very generous. So it's okay. Go where you want to go, mind. And then it's kind of like I'm siding up next to it, noticing it, being present for it. And then I kind of just, kind of once I'm up next to it, then I bring the mind back to the present. So I would say that's a little more generous than saying, oh no, that no good, lousy thinking mind. I got to rein it in. Pound it to submission. So there can be, generosity. There could be love. One of my favorite definitions for meditation is by Chogyam Trungpa. He said, meditation is the continual act of befriending oneself. Isn't that great? So again, talking about relationship. So much has to do with a relationship, as they say. It's just all relationship. So you can, are you befriending yourself? Are you becoming more friendly? Is there a loving or a kind relationship being created in meditation? And again, I've known plenty of people who sat down to meditate and has not been a kind approach. They've not been friendly towards themselves or to their experience. And so to cultivate a kind of sense of kindness, of generosity, of friendliness, of love towards oneself, towards one's experience, towards the world is greatly helpful for doing this kind of practice we're doing here. And is there wisdom? Is there some sense of paying attention and kind of being discerning, being wisely investigative, kind of beginning understanding what's going on, as opposed to just taking the surface appearance of what's happening? Is there some kind of probing and looking more deeply? What are the causes and conditions? What's happening here? What's the potential here? There's a whole range of things that wisdom can reveal that are more than just a surface appearance of how things are at the moment. So how are we meeting the world? How do we meet ourselves? What kind of relationship are we having? If you don't investigate this, because maybe it hasn't occurred to you, or because you think it's unimportant, then you're going to have a relationship regardless. Your system is going to enter into relationship to your life. And so what we're asked to do in Buddhism is to take some responsibility or some attention, apply some wisdom and understanding to this domain that's happening anyway. An automatic is often a habit. Old habits kick in. And not to leave the old habits the way they are, but to begin perhaps having a little more choice, a little more responsibility, a little more freedom in relationship to these old habits, and then finding other ways of relating to our experience. One of the ways we relate to experience in mindfulness meditation is by leaving things alone and just paying attention. So rather than actively arousing generosity or kindness or wisdom, one approach is could be called a middle way, which is not to be in relationship to the experience except to pay attention to it, except to notice what it is. So, and this is a very important thing, because if we're simply changing our relationship to a new relationship, then the mind is still in relationship to everything. There are healthy relationships to be had. There's healthy choices to be made. But your mind is always active, always engaged. I think some Buddhists in America put a high value on interrelatedness, interdependence. How the world is so interdependent, interrelated, as if it's the ultimate good. But if you go back to the teaching of the Buddha didn't take interrelatedness as being the ultimate good. But if anything, he saw it as being the problem. And we don't have to kind of accept either one, that it's ultimate good or the problem. But there's something about if we're always in relationship, then you're always going to be expending energy, always going to be kind of busy and active and going. And you're not going to have a vacation. And meditation or nirvana is kind of like a vacation from always being in relationship, always being involved. And, you know, so nowadays we have this wonderful technology that connects us so thoroughly. It used to be pretty wonderful, pretty marvelous, you know, to have a telephone. You know, you'd call, you know, I had relatives back in Norway. We'd call them, you know. It was pretty amazing, a pretty rare event. It was so expensive back then to call. And then people had cell phones initially. That was pretty amazing. And now, some people I know just can't stand how connected they are. The amount of emails and phone calls and stuff coming all the time, and the need to feel like you're connected and always involved. For some people, it's starting to become a problem, this blessing. People are overly connected. So the same thing with the mind. The mind can be overly connected, always engaged, always wanting to be in relationship, even healthy relationships. So the Buddha, he divided the activity of the mind into these two categories, healthy and unhealthy. And he said that, he said, let me switch, drop what is unhealthy, and engage in what's healthy. However, if I always engage in what's healthy, it's also tiring for me to do that. So it's necessary also to learn how to drop the healthy activity, the healthy relatedness. Now this one can be very hard for some people. It can be kind of make sense to drop what's unhealthy, but it can be very frightening for some people to drop even the healthy relatedness, because so much of who they think they are and how they orient themselves to life and how they find themselves safe in the world has to do with how they are in relationship. But the idea of not forming a relationship, not being in relationship to things, just being present in a full, clear, luminous, transparent way, can be very disorienting. And some people are like, oh, I don't want to do that. People can protest dramatically. You're not expected in Buddhist spirituality to drop once and for all relating. Relating is an important part of life. But it's considered to be important to be able to have the ability to live free of relating. So you're not a slave to relating. So you're not driven by it. So I've heard some Buddhist teachers talk about having the ability to come to zero, to the zero point. In other words, what they mean is that point where the mind is not always actively in relationship to everything and all, everywhere and every time. Just, you know, that activity of relating and relating and relating has come to rest, has been put to peace. And so when the movement, the momentum of the mind to always relate for, against things and experiences, everything, when that's put to rest and things can just be as they are without a relationship, that's a zero point. And from that zero point, it gives an amazing vantage point. It's an amazing vantage point. It gives a person amazing power to understand and see what is going on in the rest of life, what's going on in the world of relating. It also gives them the ability to choose much more wisely how they want to relate to what the experience is. If you don't have that zero point, then a little bit you're a slave, a little bit driven by something which is compulsive, something which is kind of has you. So the idea of settling in meditation, for example, is to settle all the relatedness and just be. And then from that beingness, in a sense, then when it's appropriate, choose how you want to relate to yourself or to the world around you. Now, the last thing I'll say before we can have some discussion about this is, as a person explores the relationship you have with anything, any experience at all, that relationship is very interesting. But at some point, one of the things we'll start questioning is, you know, there's two sides to a relationship, right? There's what's happening, there's your relationship, and there's the one that's having the relationship. And at some point, when the relatedness, the relating stops enough, quiets down enough, becomes peaceful enough, then you realize that the first part of the equation, the one that relates, the one that was relating, that relating one doesn't exist apart from being in relationship. You get that? Or I say it differently, that the one that was relating, the one that you know, the subject of the relationship, or the agent of the relationship, you in the relationship, it itself is an activity of relating. It doesn't exist apart from being an activity of relating. So that's another reason why people then are frightened or reluctant to let go of all relating, because if that's who you are as a subject, what's left when you stop the relating? And what's left is being at peace, phenomenal peace. So what's happening and your relationship? Two legs to walk on. So now it's your turn. Do you have any comments or questions or anything you'd like to bring up? Yes?
I have a question about relating.
Oh, if you could use the mic, it would be helpful.
I have a question about relating to things going on in the world that are not good things. Right? So one doesn't want to relate with love and acceptance to evil in the world, but one also doesn't want to relate with hate. So what is the attitude that Buddhism advises towards things in the world?
Listening to that, my relationship to that question is that it's too abstract. And it lends itself then to single response. I'd rather kind of have something more specific and say, in this situation, because I think it's often the response is situational. So in some situations, perhaps, different situations call for different kinds of responses.
That's true. I was thinking, as I was asking the question, in terms of war, in terms of the political situation in Burma, whatever, places where I don't have much control, I don't have much direct relationship. And my tendency is I can't do anything about it, avoid it. But that doesn't seem like a healthy relationship either.
No, I don't think so. I think that I think that we do a kind of violence to ourselves if we don't. It said in Buddhism that ignorance or avoidance, ignoring things, creates bad karma, which is another way of saying it's unhealthy in some way or other. And when the situations in the world are big enough, that impacts our heart in a big way, that if we ignore it or turn away from it, that we do a kind of violence to ourselves. We do kind of close ourselves down. But the question is, how do we respond to things that we can have no direct effect on? Sometimes there's doing the creative work. If it's important enough for you to find some way to contribute and try to be helpful. So there's a woman who's going to come here at supposedly at 9:00. She wants to make an announcement because she's a longtime member here, and she wants to do a garage sale in her house in Palo Alto for a cause in Burma, and she's connected through a relative who's Burmese. So she wants to kind of get help. So that's an example of someone who's kind of, we can kind of plug in. Other people here have have been asking me about how could they plug in to support the movement, what's going on in Burma. So some people want to get involved. Other people, there's so many causes in the world, there's so many tragedies in the world, you can't respond to all of them. But you can be impacted by them. And then so for example, for me, I'm inspired or moved by the things I'm troubled by, and one of my responses is I can't take care of that. That's just too much. But I think I'll try to be a better teacher. I'll try to teach better. Try to do this thing I'm doing here better. Try to make a difference here in people suffering here. Try to help transform people here. I've been changed by that, and I'm channeling the way I've been moved by it to something hopefully for good here. And that's meaningful for me to do that because I can't do it all. And hopefully there's a way in which it all spreads out. And so with some seen and unseen ways that spreads out from here. So then the question is, you brought up the idea of, is there a place, I don't know if you brought it up exactly, but is there a place for anger Is there a place for love? Is love the universal response to all things, or generosity? Or is there a time for you know, angry or violent responses? You know, how do Buddhists respond? And it takes a fair amount of discussion, that topic, if that's kind of also what you're pointing to. And one is that the I think Buddhism would say universally, categorically, that there is no healthy place in the world for responding with hostility. However, and the reason why the word hostility is very important, that word hostility is very important, is that the word anger in English has a wide range of meanings. And so when Buddhists say, you know, don't be angry, then it raises a lot of questions here in the West, because there can be ferocious saying no, there can be ferocious taking a stand on something without there being hostility. And that's sometimes called anger. And so, but what Buddhists will say, there's no place for hostility. And so the challenge for Buddhists then is, how do you find an alternative relationship? And the one that the Buddha, in his discourses, encouraged, at least his monastics, he didn't say this to lay people so much, but to monastics, was that you should always hold the person who is being hostile towards you with loving kindness. Try to find that. And you might, and actually, see, Buddhist monastics are allowed, they're not allowed to bear arms. And however, they are allowed to strike out in self-defense. I think the technical language is they're allowed to strike out as a way of escaping. So if someone's coming and gonna, you know, stab them, they're allowed to put up their hand and knock the thing away. So they're allowed to defend themselves in a sense. However, with one caveat, only if there is no hostility in their hearts. So that's a high, you know, that's a high, so, you know, high value. And so given such a high bar, in a sense, what it necessitates is spiritual training, to train oneself. You know, it might take a long time. And for me, in terms of, you know, being my initial interest in Buddhism, one of my interests was that I had a very strong pacifist beliefs. But my pacifist beliefs were not being passive. They involved being willing to do nonviolent civil disobedience that potentially could put my life on the line. And I was afraid of dying. So I felt really bad that I couldn't live my beliefs because of that fear. And so I was looking for some kind of training, some kind of way to deal with that fear. And what I came across was Buddhism. Somehow I felt that Buddhist training could help with that fear, so that when the time came, I could respond from my beliefs. So I'm going on and on. Is this addressing? Or is it more, you want to be more precise?
In what you said originally, you said the positive Buddhist way of relating to something, and you emphasized the love and the acceptance and those kinds of things. But I think there's this other side, which is relating to something as being negative but without hostility. And that was what I was looking for. How do you maintain that position of non-hostile and still, as you say, be able to say, no, this isn't right, yeah, this isn't...
So it's a good question. And there probably, I mean, again, there's a lot of different answers to that. But one answer that comes to mind now is that if you... don't have any self-image to defend. I've seen it myself. It's a lot easier to respond that way. When I'm trying to live up to some kind of image of who I'm supposed to be and try to defend it or something, then it's harder to kind of, you know, then I get caught more easily. So again, in my experience, my life, it's been training to see very clearly the self-images, the self-identities that I've been clutching to, holding on to, and learn to let go of them. And so, as I've talked about sometimes, is that I was neurotically attached to being liked. And that caused a lot of trouble for me. lot of suffering, so I learned to let go of that over time. So how to come to that zero point, how to stay there, how to stay, is it really a training? You have to really get to know yourself really well. And and since you know, the way you what you brought up was how to respond to the world situation in the world, people like Martin Luther King, when they were preparing the civil rights workers for civil disobedience, they prepared them. It wasn't just like they, you know, plucked them up one day and said, "Hey, let's go down." You know, they did weeks and weeks, you know, months of preparation so they can be ready to be that kind of way. And then there were some really, really wonderful examples of people who stood their ground, even when they were being beat up. But you know, they didn't succumb to hostility. So I'm a great believer in training, and there's all kinds of great ideals of how to live. And the world has so much need, I feel, of people who can respond, can engage. And so in order to be able to do that, and I hope that, my hope is certainly that Buddhist training, Buddhist practice, doesn't make a whole army of hermits. You know, I'm much more interested in creating an army of people who are engaged in the world in some way and have that training that... where they can do that in wise, generous, loving, non-hostile ways. Yes.
So this zero point that you mentioned, seems to me there could be sort of a near enemy to that, something that looks like you're at the zero point, but you're not really. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about what that might look like and how you might tell the difference between the two.
A good question. So in Buddhism, there's those of you who don't know this, there's a concept of the near and far enemies of certain virtues, certain good qualities that a person could have. And near enemies are something that is the opposite. It's kind of the enemy destroys the good quality, but is so close to it, seemingly, that it camouflages, looks like it, and people are confused by it. And a far enemy is something that's is so separate and distinct that no one's going to confuse it. But again, it can destroy the good quality. So, for example, the near enemy of loving kindness is sometimes said to be lust. You know, so there's a number of near enemies, but lust. You know, you feel, wow, I just love this person. You know, lust is not the same thing as, you know, kindness. And the far enemy is hate. The near enemy of equanimity is sometimes said to be indifference. And the far enemy of equanimity is, I guess, I don't know what it is. Anybody know? At the moment, what?
Chaos.
I don't know. At the moment, I don't know. And so the near enemy of the zero point. I suppose. Giving up. Some people give up and think that, you know, kind of this, you know, this is it. You know, it's really giving up. It's kind of an unhealthy surrender. I can imagine that some forms of depression can be interpreted spiritually. You know, oh, this is so, you know, I got the zero point. I'm just not motivated for anything. Yes?
I've heard said that the near enemy of the good. So the near enemy of good is the perfect.
Uh-huh.
And far enemy would be the bad. If you go for the perfect, you may not ever get there, and you may destroy the good. Great.
The near enemy of the good is the perfect. So indifference, I guess, could also be a near enemy of the zero point. Going to sleep. You know, there's a variety of kind of falling asleep or kind of get kind of dozed or spaced out. And there are some people that kind of basically are spaced out. They think it's nirvana. You know, you know, oh, yeah, I'm not relating to anything. And then it's also said that, and this is the way I heard it, so I'll just repeat it without apology. This is the way I heard it. But that sleep is the poor man's nirvana. Someone else? Yes, Charlotte. Is it a mic? No, but other people do. There are people who have hearing assistant devices. And
so, is that on?
Yes.
So you talk about moving towards generosity, say, if you're relating with ill will or greed. But my question is, and I hope this applies to some other people besides myself, that I can sort of materialize selves, and there are certain familiar selves, and some of them seem to be more functional than others. I'm not sure if I should be engaged in this materialism. I mean, I don't, you know, in other words, can you do that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Let me try to suggest something. That you're talking about how that there's different ways of self-image or different ways of manifesting yourself in the world that seem almost like different selves in different situations. And some of them are healthy, some are not. And sometimes you adjust them according to where you're at. And should you be involved in this kind of activity at all? Is that the question?
Correct.
I think it's fine. It's normal to have different kind of self manifestation in different situations. It's healthy. And the idea is to be fluid, not caught by it, not tricked by it. So, you know, it's good for me when I'm home to manifest self as father. You know, and there's certain rules or, you know, principles that need to go along with that territory and certain ways to carry myself and be. And I'm happy to leave it behind when I come down here, you know. But, you know, so there I kind of manifest a certain way of being. And as my kids change, I manifest differently. And I can change who I am, in a sense, in relationship to them. And when I'm here at IMC, I manifest a little bit more, or I kind of act on the principle more that I'm a teacher. And I try just to be myself. Certainly that's a high value, just be myself. But I can't, being myself is something, again, it exists in relationship. And who I am is also here, in this setting, is a teacher. And that comes with certain kind of parameters, comes with certain kind of cares and concerns that I have to be aware of and have to include. And so sometimes I'm happy to go home and put that down, leave that behind. So in different situations, you know, we participate in different constructs. Now if it's exhausting or it feels like, it can be exhausting, it can feel like there's a lot of shoulds, it can feel confining, it can feel like, you know, if you're doing it in order to please someone, you're doing it in order to make yourself safe, you're doing it in order to prove to the world how great you are, then it's, you know, self-defeating, or then it's exhausting. But it can be done for wise reasons. Like, I hope it's wise, you know, that I, when I'm at home, that I manifest myself as a father, you know. Otherwise, you know, these kids need a father, you know. And my wife needs them to have a father. And hopefully it's wise that, hopefully the way I manifest myself here as a teacher, hopefully that works for people, hopefully that's helpful, you know, and that could stop. But, you know, so, does that make sense? Is this helpful at all? Because it's an important question you're asking, so I want to make sure that...
Yeah, I guess what I'm mainly asking is, if there's one self that's better at generosity, is it worth investing... It takes a little bit of sort of awareness to stay in that self rather than moving into...
Yeah. So it's a little bit hard to know what you mean by the self that you're talking about. However, the generic answer that I like to give is, I don't have any answers for you. You find out for yourself by trial and error. And so you try it out and you see what is beneficial for you, what supports you. So you try out the generous self for a week and then see, does that actually make your life more peaceful, more subtle, and more helpful? And if it does, then that's maybe a route you want to follow for a while. But maybe after 5 months, it's enough of that one. You've done it enough. So you become your own teacher that way. Okay. So thank you all, and so enjoy your relating.